Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest this week is co-founder of the streaming fraud prevention company BeatDap, Morgan Hayduk. But let's start here. We all know about wearable tech, and while it's never quite caught on the way some pundits thought it might, there may be a new use for it in the music industry. UK-based physical music and packaging manufacturer Key Production has announced their smart formats, which are physical products that use NFC technology to embed digital access codes that fans can then use to get bonus content like music or videos or messages from artists and much more. NFC stands for Near Field Communication, which is a short-range wireless technology for delivery of very small payloads between devices. Now, these devices could be wristbands or badges or keyrings, mugs, t-shirts, slip mats, just about anything you can think of. Now, the interesting thing is these are going to be chart certified and actually registered as two sales, once for the physical format and once for the digital smart version. If these catch on as a standard piece of merch, it could give artists a new source of revenue and prove that wearable technology really does have a place in our world. If you have any comments or questions, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. You can find out all about my books, including The Mixing Engineer's Handbook, Recording Engineer's Handbook, AI for Music Production, The Music Business Advice Book, and more at bobbyosinski.com. There you can also read excerpts from all of my books and learn all about the latest in music, audio, and production news when you sign up for my newsletter. That's bobbyosinski.com. Vinyl record sales are growing around the world, and although it's really a small part of the overall music business, it's still a sector that shows no signs of slowing down. That said, there's still a lot of common questions about the format that I'm going to answer here today. So for instance, the big one is, what is a vinyl record really made of? Well, it's made of PVC or polyvinyl chloride, which is the same material that plumbing pipes are made of. Now, PVC can last for at least 100 years, although there are other factors that go into the longevity of a record, but it's not great for the environment. How many times can you play a record? If you listen to some purists, they will tell you that it deteriorates with the first play, and actually it really does, but most people will say that you can play it hundreds of times without a really big loss of sound quality. It really depends on the care, which we'll get to in a second, and also the weight of the vinyl. For instance, 180 gram versus 140 gram vinyl. The 180 gram, the thicker one, heavier one, is going to sound better. It's going to last longer as well. So what really affects longevity? Extreme heat is one thing because it warps the discs and then they become unplayable. Excessive humidity is another one because all of a sudden you'll get mold growth on the record. Sunlight is no good for a vinyl record because it breaks down to PVC. Poor handling is really bad. For instance, getting dirt in the grooves, even fingerprints. And storage is a big factor, because if you don't stack the discs vertically, in other words, you lay them on top of one another horizontally, then that doesn't help as well because eventually they begin to warp. So the big question is, how long do vinyl records last? Well, first of all, CDs are going to last for about 100 years, it's estimated. Recordable CDs, CDRs, will only last about 20 years. Cassettes, they figure about 30 years, but vinyl will go for about 100 years if handled and stored correctly. In the end, the vinyl record looks like it'll be a format that will be around for a very long time. My guest this week is Morgan Hayduk, who's the co-founder and co-CEO of BeatDap, a company that helps artists, labels, performance rights organizations, and even streaming platforms detect fraudulent streams. Morgan started his career as a music lobbyist for the Canadian music industry in the area of copyright protection before starting BeatDap, although the company's original mission was as a streaming auditing tool for record labels. After many conversations with record execs, it became clear that just about everyone in the industry was having a problem with streaming manipulation, and that led to inconsistencies between sales reports and streaming services' server logs. As a result, BeatDap developed a tool that would detect fraudulent streams and prevent them from impacting royalty payouts. Industry estimates that anywhere from 10 to 20% of all streams are fraudulent, so BeatDap's tool is critical to restoring full payouts to artists everywhere. During our interview, Morgan spoke about the two goals of streaming fraud, why fraud can't be detected in a royalty statement, why even AI music companies are worried about streaming fraud, the various different types of streaming fraud, and much more. I spoke with Morgan via Zoom from his office in Los Angeles. First of all, tell me about your background and how you got from where you started to BTAP.
Yeah. I've always had a pretty deep love and appreciation for music. My dad was a decent guitar player in his day and played in a band, not a famous one, but he introduced me to playing guitar, and that was with me from a pretty early age. And then as luck would have it, when I graduated university and I started my career as a consultant, my first client was the Canadian music industry. It was Music Canada, so the trade association that represents Sony, Warner, and Universal. And then also a Canadian independent entertainment company that had a large label called Entertainment One, which subsequently sold to Hasbro and then I think to Blackstone and is now called Monarch Music. But I had two music clients, and it was just happenstance. I didn't choose the firm because of the music sort of focus, and I certainly didn't know that they would be my clients when I got in there, but got to work on one fairly consequential piece of legislation that passed, which was the extension of copyright protection from 50 to 70 years in Canada, bringing that in line with the rest of the world. And that was sort of my entry point to the business of music. And it's funny because I don't think copyright extension or even copyright law is necessarily the sexiest part of the industry. It's not where everyone sets out to work. But fast forwarding many years, it's a pretty formative education in how money actually moves through the industry. And if you want to build a business in music that isn't, you know, a record label or, you know, music management, but you're interested in the sort of business of music, and particularly in our case, technology that supports artists and labels and everyone who makes their living in music, honestly, that foundational knowledge is really helpful. So spent a number of years at the consulting firm, worked on a bunch of different music files, but that copyright extension was the big one. Then I went to a big Canadian telecommunications company, which has nothing to do with music, and where I joked that my job was to keep Canadian cell phone bills high. It wasn't really, but that's what the Canadians would tell us. And then my wife and I moved out to LA, and so I did a couple different things in LA and was at a technology company that was sort of pre-IPO, and an exciting time to sort of see the inner workings of, you know, large tech sort of venture back hyperscaling in the run-up to going public. So while I was in LA, went to a venture-backed tech company. It was sort of in the run-up to their IPO, and that was an exciting view into the world of hyper-growth technology and sort of scaling. And then had the idea along the way with my co-founder, Andrew, for a company in music. And his background was in sort of promotional side of the music industry. And so he had a very different lens through which he saw everything, but we were really sort of simpatico on what we thought of as was one of the problems we could address, which is where the company started. And we've known each other for years. We did our master's degrees together and just were long friends, always wanted to build something. We're waiting for the right idea or inspiration to strike. And it came in the form of a conversation with someone from a music label who I stayed in touch with over the years and put us onto the initial idea for BTAP, which was an auditing solution. That isn't necessarily where the company is today. We can talk about how we got to where we are, but it was the sort of kernel of inspiration, the first idea that gave us, you know, enough meat to grab onto with enough relevant background experience to say, okay, let's do this. And so we started BTAP from there.
Okay, so let's talk about BTAP. So you pivoted, let's put it like that, as you went along. So how did that happen?
So, I mean, I think it's a very similar story for a lot of companies. You start with an idea, you know enough for the idea to have some real legs and traction. And fundamentally, I think an auditing tool for the music industry that is not just hiring one of the big five accounting firms to come in and do the financial audit, particularly of the DSPs, on behalf of the rights holders, is something that technology will inevitably play a much bigger role in. But what we found was we were trying to understand why there was a discrepancy between what was being reported to a rights holder and what was showing up at the sort of server log level on the platforms. And what we didn't know at all at that time was streaming fraud, or what I now think of as streaming fraud. So we were having these conversations with streaming services, and we were asking, you know, well, first of all, we were presenting our idea of being a more efficient auditor, which went over about as well as you could imagine. No one wants to be audited more effectively. So that didn't go super far. But we kept coming back and asking the same question, which was like, okay, well, why are there these discrepancies? If, you know, the rights holders aren't making them up, there's clearly something to this. What accounts for that? And that's when we started to hear streaming fraud. But we didn't necessarily hear it as streaming fraud on day one. We heard spin juicing, we heard spin manipulation, we heard streaming manipulation, we heard streaming fraud, we heard bot farms, we heard, you know, all kinds of different names from a whole bunch of different places describing what was the same problem. And so that was kind of an aha moment for Andrew and myself and the team, where we went, okay, if everyone is describing the same thing and it seems to account for the majority of the perceived discrepancy between what shows up in a sales report and what's on the logs, and there's no common vocabulary shared between the parties, then there's probably no one sitting in the middle helping them to do this. And they're all trying to figure it out on their own. And I think in a lot of cases, really good businesses get built when you identify a problem that is central to the effective, you know, administration of the company, but isn't the reason the company exists. So Spotify, Apple, Amazon, SoundCloud, down the list, they don't exist to solve streaming fraud. They don't exist to find anomalies in their data, certainly not negative anomalies, positive ones for playlisting and other purposes, maybe, but they don't exist to solve streaming fraud. And yet they're facing this challenge that is persistent across the industry and is a cost and tax on the business to ultimately offer what they want to, which is a compelling service to customers and to be a faithful, accurate payment partner to the rights holders, where, you know, that's where the business comes from. And so that was sort of the moment where we went, all right, there's something here, because this explains the problem in a different way that we sort of know exists. And also there is not an unlimited, but there is a sizable amount of domain knowledge in the fraud space because of all of the online verticals that came before music that established their prominence and became, you know, massively successful online. So advertising, digital advertising in particular, the early days of the Google AdWords product was, you know, riddled with different forms of manipulation. E-commerce, if you go back and you read the origin stories of PayPal, you'll find there's a really compelling chapter in one of the more recent books where they discovered how big of a problem fraud was going to be, and they had to stand up a fraud team almost overnight to combat fraud on PayPal, or they wouldn't have been able to continue operating the business. And so we started looking out and saying, all right, let's look at all the verticals that are affected by fraud and draw a little bit on, you know, what they did well and what the challenges they were facing, and see how many of those examples at least line up a little bit with what we saw in music. And there's no perfect apples to apples comparison, but there was enough similarity that we weren't flying totally blind in terms of what needed to be built. And then we just needed a streaming service to come along and say, work with us, because you can't do the analysis without the data. And the data is the hardest things to get your hand on. And so fortunately, we had a very early partner who believed enough in what we were doing and our capability to let us start building what were the first versions of our fraud detection models on their streaming data. And once we got into the data, it was, and we're very fortunate that at the time, and still to this day, he's our head of data science. We had one really strong data scientist on staff who was just able to go in and start building models, and come up with something that was workable. And as soon as we saw the output of his work, we realized, okay, if this level of, you know, manipulation is persistent across all of the platforms, this is a great big problem and someone needs to do something. And so that gave us the, you know, the proof point to then be able to go out to the rest of the industry and say, you know, we're going to become the market leader in this. We're going to take this problem off your hands. We would happily, you know, chew all this garbage for you because we know it's not your core competency. And that became really what the core of the business is today.
Okay, so let's talk about streaming fraud then. Describe it. What is it? Because I know it can happen in multiple forms when it comes to music.
Totally. There are lots of different shapes. I mean, fraud's a funny space. The deeper we get into it, the more we realize the limitless capacity of creative people to do bad things on the internet. But really, it boils down to two things to me. One is someone is trying to make money, and the other is someone is trying to alter the perception of their own success. And that's true not just in music, but in all of the other, whether it's Instagram fraud trying to get likes and followers and, you know, post views, or financial fraud where it's trying to extract payments from, you know, these intermediaries. But in music, it really takes those two shapes. So my instinct when we started the business, and I've been proven wrong, thankfully, on this, is that the perception motivation would be the bigger of the two. That music, you know, it's music. People, it matters where you chart. It matters not just that you show up on a playlist, but that you're in the first couple of songs on that playlist. And it has all these knock-on implications for, you know, charting, for touring, for, you know, Grammy Awards. There's so many reasons why the perception motivation is real. And it's not to say that that doesn't exist. There's certainly some of that. But the much bigger problem when we looked at the data was the financially motivated fraud. The people who just looked at music and said, ah, here is a growing pot of money that is fairly loosely guarded on the internet. And if we can put a song onto a streaming service and we can stream that song a number of times, we get a check in the mail. And if we're really sophisticated, we'll go and make sure we register that work with PROs and anywhere else so that we're getting all of the revenue streams associated with the, you know, soup sandwich that is copyright, you know, revenues that flow through to the end rights holder. But fundamentally, it was more than 80% of what we were finding was in that financially motivated bucket. And so the big difference there is, if you're not trying to look successful, then what you're really trying to do is hide in the long tail. You're trying to hide your tracks, sometimes thousands or tens of thousands of tracks, hundreds of fake artists. You're just trying to hide them in the long tail of music that gets a handful of streams up to maybe thousands or millions of streams, but you're not trying to appear on release radar. You're not trying to chart. And so a very different, you know, tactic deployed in those cases than in the ones where you're trying to look popular. And so there's a whole bunch of different ways that you can do that. We talk more about it. But really it boils down to those two motivations and then deploying a couple of different tools to try to, you know, successfully either make money or change the perception of your own success.
Okay. So is this for artists or is this for labels that you're doing or both, I guess, right?
Yeah. So that's a great question. The ultimate, I think, beneficiary of our work and the thing that motivates and animates our team is that if we're successful in eliminating fraud from streaming, the artists, all shapes and sizes, big and small, stand to benefit from the elimination of fraud because it moves market share back to them. Right? Changes how much of the revenue pot is allocated to legitimate artistry and not fraudsters. The challenge is that at an individual artist level, even if you're Lady Gaga, you have very little power and control in policing fraud. There's almost nothing you can do. And so it's one of those funny things where the beneficiary of the work or one of the beneficiaries of the work really has no ability to do any of this on their own. Lady Gaga could give me all of her, you know, royalty statements for going back a decade, and I wouldn't be able to do anything with it from a fraud detection standpoint. I could look at, you know, whether she was paid correctly from all the services or not. Or if there's any weird patterns, but that doesn't tell us anything about fraud. So our customers end up needing to be in one of five groups. Streaming services themselves, which is sort of the first and most important because they have the most granular data on all of the behavior that happens on their platform, not just what was listened to, but who listened to it, how they discovered it, how they navigated the application, what operating system they're working on, where in the world they are when they stream. So you see all kinds of funny tells in the data, like people who are on, you know, 35 different devices and 50 countries in a week. Seems unreasonable. It seems unusual. So there's lots of tells that come. So streaming service data is very helpful. We now also work with collection societies. We'll have another one, a big one. I was hoping it would be out this week. It's probably going to be next week, but we'll very soon another big collection society that we're working with. And that's a vertical that we're interested in expanding. We do some work with distributors. We do some work with labels, particularly the major labels, largely because they get a slightly more descriptive data set to analyze than some of the smaller labels do. And then an emerging bucket for us are AI generative music companies. So not the ones that are currently in trouble, but some of the ones that realize that their models are the biggest unlock for one of the biggest unlocks for fraudsters at scale, right? So like, think about it, maybe going back 5 years, if you wanted to run a highly scaled fraud scheme, you needed a bunch of music. And coming into a bunch of music, if you're not a recording artist yourself and you don't want to just make the sound of your blender running in the kitchen, all of your tracks, you need something that sounds passably like music to put onto the platforms. That was hard to find. Now, with the push of a button, I can create thousands of songs a day. So some of these companies have recognized that their tools, while they want them to be used for good and for creative purposes, can also be kind of weaponized against them. And so they've had us start looking at not so much the streaming behavior because they're not a DSP, but actually the act of creation itself, how an how a user comes onto the platform and creates music and then publishes it. And there are some really nice tells in what a normal creative, you know, artist does on a platform and what they spend their time on and what they care about versus what someone who's just coming on to like blitz scale creation and push music out of their system as fast as possible. And so we're almost serving as like a KYC function for some of these emerging tech companies before their music is distributed and published and kind of leaves their side of the house. We're putting their users through some extra scrutiny if they start to display behavior that makes us think they're not there as artists. They're there as, you know, industrial scale creators of sounds.
I can, off the top of my head, think of what one of those data points would be. Because if it's a real artist, an artist is going to redo the prompt and redo the prompt and redo the prompt until they finally get something that they like. But if you're on an industrial scale, it's like anything will do. Just push it out.
Exactly. And you can see, and it's funny because you can see where they spend their time very clearly in the data, right? Like you get the, not just which features they use, but how many seconds per page. Yeah. So not to give away the blueprint for how to do this effectively, but yeah, there are some pretty obvious points and then some less obvious and more subtle sort of correlations that exist between different behaviors. But some of the obvious ones are pretty clear in a lot of cases.
So you find evidence of fraud, then what?
So we do a few things. Just talk about it from the DSP perspective for a second. So the first thing is music has a nice built-in lag in terms of payments. It's not real time. It's not like the second a song is streamed, someone gets a check in the mail or gets a you know, contribution to a PayPal account. And so that lag gives us a window to do analysis retroactively on a platform and then provide a report to the platform ahead of when they're going to make their monthly distributions to rights holders and give them an analysis that says, here's what you should pay and here's what you definitely should not pay. And so that in effect changes the market share in the favor of all of the legitimate rights holders and flow through benefits to all of the artists. That's sort of number one. So on a monthly basis, we're providing reporting back to our clients to say, pay this, not that. We were very intentional from the beginning about saying, this isn't going to be a black box algorithm where we just tell you pay this, not that, and that's the extent of our work. We're going to give you flags. So you get, you know, specific written descriptions in the data that we give back that explains why this was selected as the fraudulent cohort and why this wasn't. And it's important because ultimately somebody in some cases, somebody's going to ask the question, why didn't I get paid? And the answer needs to be more than just, well, because. So we're really intentional about that. So stopping the payments is one. The second thing that we do on a daily or a weekly basis is the same analysis, not necessarily as fine-grained as what we ultimately put into the sales reports, but it helps catch the obvious examples of chart manipulation or algorithm manipulation. So on a daily basis, before the charts go up for the internal charts of the platform or before that data is exported externally to a chart partner, we're giving a view of here's some really obvious examples of things that probably shouldn't make it into the charts. And here are some songs that you may want to exclude from your algorithmic playlists because they're showing evidence of manipulation. And so what that stops, particularly the algorithmic piece, is if your intention is, you know, to change the perception of your own success, a great way to do that is to introduce a little fake velocity at the beginning, right after something is released, have it get picked up by algorithmic playlists that are distributed to legitimate users, and then have your volume expand naturally, organically, on the back of it being included on a popular and widely distributed playlist. And so we think that's a really important thing to try to weed out. So those are two. The third thing that we do on the DSP side, and this is maybe the most interesting to me, we can distinguish now between a stolen account and a bot. And so we'll give you a report that says, in addition to the streams that shouldn't be paid on, here are the users that we suspect with high confidence are bots. And you might take a different approach to how you deal with those users. Then here are a group of users that are clearly in 90%, 80%, doesn't matter, in some percentage of their listening, they're a legitimate user. But then there are a couple of devices associated with that account that are behaving entirely differently. So not only should we not pay on the streams that come from those suspicious devices, but you also probably want to reset the passwords of those users and get the compromised actor off the account as quickly as possible. And so by distinguishing between those two things, it means that we're not painting with quite as wide of a brush on just demonetizing bad activity outright, still allowing the legitimate users' royalties to accrue to the artists that they, you know, labels or whatever that they care about. But you're taking a bit of a scalpel to like the bad actors and making sure you demonetize them and you get the accounts back in the hands of the legitimate user as fast as possible. So those things all together are really the value proposition for what we do. And I guess the one other thing is just from a cost standpoint, by focusing all of our time and energy and attention on this, you get a great big team working on it of experts, and we still tend to cost a lot less than what it would take to staff an equivalent team on the client side and do the same sort of work.
What you just mentioned brings up the thought about false positives, which is something that artists hate, especially like on YouTube. It makes people crazy. So how do you deal with that?
I would say if there's anything that gives our team as a whole like real heartburn, it's the fear of false positives. Because, you know, when you're an umpire and you're in the business of calling balls and strikes, you need to be pretty damn accurate. And especially when the folks that your work could negatively impact are as passionate and as vocal as the artist community, you really don't want to get it wrong, mostly because you want to do right by everybody who's legitimately trying to earn a living in music. And it's hard enough to do that without having, you know, someone inadvertently calling your life's work fraud. So we spend a lot of time thinking about that. We're probably more conservative in a lot of cases than we need to be. So in some instances, we'll report sort of three different buckets back to a client. There's the obviously fraud with high confidence. And when we say high confidence, we mean like 99.9999% accuracy. I don't have any heartburn over what we call fraud in that context. Like those, we're not getting any flags from rights holders to say, no, you missed one here, you called something wrong. But then we'll have a suspicious bucket. And the confidence in the suspicious bucket might still be above, you know, 85 or 90% confidence, but it's not high enough to say this is definitively fraud. And then you'll have the benign bucket. And so what we'll do with the suspicious bucket is we'll basically just quarantine those tracks for a while and those artists, and we'll watch them over a couple of periods. And we'll see not just how the tracks and the artists behave and perform, but also how the users associated with those streams are behaving. And once you get to a place, you know, usually it only takes a month or two of watching. But once you get to a place where you've looked at an artist or a track for long enough, you get a pretty good sense of like, was this a one-off aberration because something happened on TikTok and things went crazy and it deviated from what you would expect for this artist? Or is this a persistent campaign that's clearly being funded and fueled to be streaming fraud? And so I think we've yet to have a problem with false positives. I knock wood when I say that, but we're pretty confident in our ability to discern between the two. And one thing that we did as a business, this is the question, but it's probably the most important question that we get asked. You know, it's one thing to just take our reports and use them, but ultimately the people who use our reporting are accountable to someone else. They're accountable to the rights holder, in this case, the artist, the label. And so we, after we got our sort of confidence up around our modeling and our ability to do this, we said, well, then we're going to take some insurance out. We're going to make our errors and omissions coverage stipulate that if we're wrong, we're on the hook for the loss. If someone comes back to us after a couple of years and proves in an audit that something we called fraud was in fact a legitimate moment on TikTok and that we were wrong, the DSP is not going to have, our client, the DSP is not going to have to backstop that loss in a proven instance where our reporting was wrong. That's on us. And that's one where I'm very thankful to say that we've never had to even go down the path of using, and I hope we never do. But we knew we had to put some skin in the game over and above just our reputation, because the implications are pretty serious.
I like that, definitely. What platforms have the most fraud and which ones have the least?
This is a great question that I really can't answer directly. So I'm sorry in advance for the fact that I'm going to take a long walk around the barn on you here. But look, we've said publicly that we think about 10% of all streaming is manipulated. We've seen platforms that are much higher than that. We've seen platforms that are lower than that. The challenge or the problem is that it almost doesn't matter what the percentage is. If every point of market share is worth about $200 million and growing, if the fraud rate is 2%, do we care about it as an industry? Yes. If it's 20, do we really care? Of course. But anywhere along that scale, and no one is zero. And honestly, I don't think anyone is one or two or three. But if you're north of a few points of market share all the way up to the folks who are, you know, in some periods, 20% fraud on their platform, that has real consequences for the industry revenues as a whole. So from my perspective, everyone wants to know, like, who's the worst at this and who's the best? And yeah, in another life, I would be happy to tell. But in this one, I can't. And so what I tend to end up saying is this, right? Like this the amount of money represented by each point of market share is consequential enough on its own that and there's no disagreement that the problem exists. So now we're just talking about a, you know, question of scale or degree, but not existence. And to me, it's worth solving if it's a 1% problem, which it's not. It's certainly worth solving if it's a 10% problem.
Now, I take it that the way you're detecting fraud is by looking at the data, the usage data on everything, to see if there's any anomalies along the way, which is opposed to like something like Content ID on YouTube, which it looks completely different at it. And the problem being that if you speed up a track or slow it down or something like that, it's not catching it all the time. So you're coming at it from a different direction then, right?
Completely.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the byproducts of our analysis is we do find instances of copyright infringement. So we will find songs targeted by bot farms that are in every way, shape, and form identical to the legitimate rights holder, but for the fact that the distributor is different and ultimately the recipient of the royalties is not the artist or the label associated. And so we found cases where thousands of albums are duplicates, carbon copies that have made it through various content identification methods, ended up on the platforms looking and feeling exactly like what the artist created and released, but with the payment flowing to someone else. And so we do find copyright infringement as a byproduct, but we don't look at the audio at all. We don't take the audio files. We only look at the data associated with each stream and with all of the users. And so it's lighter from an analysis standpoint, lighter in the sense that we're not looking at as heavy of a file as actually ingesting the audio every time. But it's sort of a nice complement to Content ID, which is an incredible, like the sort of Content ID universe is pretty incredible technology. But it's like all, you know, detection efforts, you can still circumvent it. And you can certainly in the world of AI, where you can create brand new tracks, the push of a button, you don't need to go and infringe on someone else's IP to have a repertoire of work that you're putting onto platforms to commit streaming fraud. And so, yeah, we focus on the data itself and not the audio files, but I think we complement anyone who's doing audio detection quite nicely.
I think you would find indie artists who haven't quite cracked how to exploit what they're doing say, I'm not making any money from my tracks, or I'm not making all that much. How is it that I can have a fraudster do tracks that are similar to mine and yet they're making money? And you're talking about the long tail, and here we go, a
Yeah.
long tail. They're making money in a long tail, and I, as an artist, am not.
Super frustrating. I mean, look, you can't, this is what I think is frustrating. It's hard to find an audience, right? Like, and that's an, there's an artistic question there. There's also a, you know, access and availability question. And there's lots of great music that probably never gets discovered that if it was, excuse me, had it, you know, arrived at a different moment, had it found a different channel to sort of market, it would have been massively successful. I can't help there. I mean, I wish I could, but I can't. What I can help with is, to your question, the people who find an audience, but that audience is all bots. Like, that sucks. Because now you're not just competing on the merits of your art, you're competing against the artificial, you know, ability of tens of thousands of computer programs running concurrently to, you know, generate more streams, appear more popular or not, but just generate more streams than yours. And so that's really where we live is we're not in the subjective sort of taste making business, and thankfully, but we are in the business of making sure that the playing field is level so that you're competing on the merits of your life's work and your art, as opposed to competing against someone who has, you know, it's like the, I don't know what the analogy is, using steroids in the Olympics. Like it's not a like for like comparison. And so we want to make sure that at least that part of the playing field is as level as possible.
How about non-music content? And I guess it doesn't matter, right? Because you're just looking at the data. So whether it's music or not, you'd probably see the pro the if there's a problem there, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a point of frustration for many folks in the industry, labels, even the platforms themselves, who I think what sometimes gets left out of the conversation is whatever gets put onto a streaming service then has to be indexed and made available in search, tagged appropriately for all of the, you know, various metadata tags that are going to influence how it's, you know, sorted, filtered, categorized, what genre it goes into, which playlist it appears on, which it doesn't, and stored. And there's a cost associated with all of that. Now, I don't know that, you know, a streaming service needs 68,000 variants of white noise. I know why they need a few. I'm a parent. I've got two small kids. Give me that white noise all day.
Yeah.
At certain points in my life, I probably looked like a bot for how much white noise I was streaming. But you can't tell me that I need, you know, the entire 68,000 white noise variants, you know, repertoire to sort through to find just the right one for my kids. So I think that is the sort of non-music content is frustrating for a bunch of reasons. And a ton of it is what appears in fraud schemes, right? Because, yeah, to our earlier point, you can go and use a, you know, new model to create country music, 50s funk, whatever you want, maybe 50s a little early for funk, but you get my point. Or you can just make whale sounds and blender noises and, you know, nails falling out of a bag. In some ways, it doesn't really matter, except for the fact that it becomes a little more obvious when you're looking at hundreds of tracks that are all indecipherable white noise, and they're all being listened to by the same group of what turns out to be fake users. Like, from a sophistication of your scheme standpoint, the preference would be to use what passably sounds like music as opposed to what clearly is just noise. But there's a seemingly unlimited supply of white noise purveyors and various other sounds. And I think some of that is going to start to get boxed in a little bit, because what are we at now? 200,000 songs a day being uploaded to streaming services. At some point, you know, they can't just be the photo sharing bucket of everything that's ever been created, being indexed and made available to consumers. And so I think some of the guardrails that you're starting to see some of the platforms put around minimum numbers of streams per month or minimum numbers of listeners, they're not intended. I know they get cast sometimes as punitive to independent artists, but that's not really why they're there. They're there because at some point you have to put a stop on the whale sounds. And it's really hard to do it in a way where you're stopping them on upload. If we're going to have democratized access to streaming services, which I think is a good thing for the industry, then you probably don't want a subjective filter on the gate, right? Like some tool or technology or person who's there going, passably music, not. Passably music, not. Because that introduces all kinds of bias and subjectivity that I think artists would go, no. Like, we cannot have, you know, a world where there's just, you know, 40 folks at DSPs who decide what's art and what isn't. So if you're not going to do that, then how are you going to make the same sort of determination after the fact? Listenership is a good proxy for that. It's imperfect, but it's a good proxy for it.
Is there a certain part of the world that has more fraudsters in it?
So there are places that are hotbeds for what I would call the supply chain of fraud. And then there are the people who are using the tools. And so on a people using the tools basis, and a lot of this is masked by how many VPN users there are on the internet now, you can appear to be from wherever you want. If you want your royalties to come from Switzerland because it pays a higher effective per stream rate than Brazil, cool. You can do that with a VPN. But there are places, you know, Russia, some areas in Asia, where a lot of the bad actors who just build tools for a living and sell them for any number of purposes, whether that's stealing your, you know, login credentials from malware that's deployed onto your machine or your browser, to spinning up bot farms at scale and selling them to people who are interested in, you know, Taylor Swift tickets, Nike sneaker releases, and streaming farms. They don't care. They're agnostic to what the scheme is. They're just providing the tools. Those people and those groups tend to concentrate in harder to prosecute jurisdictions. So while you'll see bot farms and bot farm operators that exist in the US or the supply chain in the US and Canada and England and other places, you know, if I was running the supply chain of this stuff, I would probably prefer to be domiciled somewhere that doesn't have a great record on extradition. And so you kind of tend to see, and that we don't know that from the data. Like, it's not showing up in the streaming data. That's what we know from spending time in the, you know, dark web and in the forums where these folks talk about what they do, and getting a sense of, okay, we might not know who the person is on the other side of this anonymous, you know, chat group forum, you know, handle, but we do know that they speak Russian. So that helps. It's a good tell.
All right, Morgan, last question. What's the best piece of advice that either you learned along the way or maybe somebody imparted to you?
Specific to the business I'm in now, I have a different answer for just generally in life, but from the business that I'm in, and I think speaking really to artists, it's cliche, but there's a reason why things become cliches. If it looks too good to be true, it probably is. That applies to the promotional world in a way that I don't think you can take it too seriously. If you look at something and it's promising you, guaranteeing you playlist placements, minimum numbers of streams, minimum numbers of followers, listeners, whatever it might be, don't just take that and say, this must be the most effective marketing company on the planet, and go and use their services. I've seen some really devastating examples of, especially with independent labels, who spent tens of thousands of dollars of marketing budget to buy a guaranteed number of streams, only to have very few of those streams materialize and almost no recourse to get their money back, because it's pretty hard to put your hand up and say, well, I bought a guaranteed number of streams, and there's no better business bureau protecting, you know, that transaction. So that's my advice to artists, to labels, to marketing folks, to anybody who doesn't want to inadvertently get caught in the crossfire of, you know, having streams demonetized and having artists banned from platforms, because there are so many different promotional tactics you can take, and there are so many different ways that you can share your art and your career and your personality with an audience and find a home for your music. But the one thing that I'm certain of is, if you buy streams, and eventually you are going to get caught. And unfortunately, especially for independent artists, if you get caught, that can be a career-ending move, because you might not get a second chance. So that's probably my best advice, is too good to be true, probably is. Ask for references. Talk to another customer. Do all of the things you would do if you were buying a used car. Don't just presume because someone has a website and a chat function that they are a legitimate, good actor, and that they are going to do the thing that they say for you and for your career.
You can find out more about Morgan and BeatDap at BeatDap.com. That's BeatDap, 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 all one word, .com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@BobbyOsinski.com. You can also learn all about the latest in music, audio, and production news when you sign up for my newsletter at BobbyOsinski.com. There you'll also find out about openings for my latest online classes and special events. That's BobbyOsinski.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to BobbyOsinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to BobbyOinnerCircle.com, or you can find it in Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Mixcloud, YouTube Music, Spotify, Deezer, TuneIn Radio, Radio Public, and Podbean. At BobbyOsinski.com and BobbyOinnerCircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.